A 9-year-old boy discovers people in striped pajamas living behind a fence near his new home. He doesn't understand why they're there or why they look so sad and thin. He only knows he's lonely and wants a friend. This simple premise drives one of the most devastating novels about the Holocaust ever written, not because it shows us graphic horrors, but because it reveals them through eyes too innocent to comprehend what they're seeing. John Boyne's novel has sold over 11 million copies worldwide, embraced by readers from Oprah Winfrey to middle school students, translated into more than 50 languages. Why does this story resonate so powerfully? Because it forces us to see history's darkest chapter through a perspective that makes the incomprehensible somehow more real. When a child cannot grasp the evil surrounding him, we're confronted with how such evil could exist at all. Bruno's story isn't just about one boy's tragic fate. It's about how innocence collides with ideology, how ordinary people become complicit in extraordinary evil, and how the simple human need for connection can transcend even the most brutal divisions. Bruno's Berlin life was idyllic. He lived in a magnificent 5-story house with a perfect banister for sliding. He had 3 best friends for life, Carl, Daniel, and Martin, boys who shared comic books and playground adventures. His neighborhood buzzed with pastry shops, rainbow-colored vegetable stalls, outdoor cafes, and children playing hopscotch. Then Maria, the family maid, started packing. His mother, eyes red and swollen, explained that father's promotion from the Fury required an immediate move. The new house crushes Bruno's spirit. 3 floors instead of 5. Small windows admitting only gray light instead of sunlight flooding large rooms. The house stands isolated in a desolate landscape. No other homes visible, no children playing outside. The atmosphere feels cold and joyless, matched by the permanently overcast sky. Bruno protests vehemently, but his mother insists he must make the best of a bad situation. Bruno's only consolation in his new room is a window. What he sees makes him feel very cold and unsafe. His 12-year-old sister Gretel, whom he considers trouble from day one, joins him to investigate. They discover people of all ages wearing identical striped pajamas, some walking with bowed heads, others standing in straight lines, still others working at incomprehensible tasks. Below spreads a beautiful garden with roses, daffodils, and tulips, but 20 feet beyond stands an enormous wire fence extending endlessly, its top crowned with barbed wire. Beyond lies desolation, bare earth, rows of identical low huts, large square buildings, and ominous smokestacks continuously billowing dark clouds. Gretel attempts to rationalize the scene as the countryside, where farmers work. Bruno, despite being younger, shows remarkable perceptiveness, pointing out the absence of farm animals. When he asks his father for clarity, the response chills. They're not people at all, Bruno, at least not as we understand the term. The fence becomes both physical barrier and powerful symbol, dividing 2 moral universes, separating childhood innocence from harsh adult awareness, perpetrators from victims. After months of boredom at Outwith, his childish mispronunciation of Auschwitz, Bruno explores along the fence. Walking nearly an hour, he spots a boy in striped pajamas with a cloth cap and star armband, gray skin, large caramel-colored eyes, appearing skinnier and sadder than anyone he's ever seen. They introduce themselves, Bruno the explorer and Shmuel, the boy from the other side. Astonishingly, they share the exact same birthday, April 15, 1934. This coincidence forms an immediate bond. Shmuel describes life before the camp, living above his father's watch shop in Krakow, wearing armbands, being forced into a crowded ghetto, then transported in airless train cars with hundreds crammed together. Genuine friendship develops through daily visits. When Lieutenant Kotler catches Shmuel eating chicken Bruno offered, Bruno denies knowing him out of fear. A week later, Shmuel returns with a badly bruised face. Bruno apologizes profusely, Shmuel forgives him, and they reach under the fence and shake hands, their first touch, representing human connection transcending artificial barriers. The household servants reveal the human cost of silence under totalitarianism. Maria, the family maid, shares her gratitude when Bruno complains about their move. Father employed her when desperate, arranged hospital care for her dying mother, and paid for her funeral. Yet as she gazes toward the distant huts, her voice cracks with emotion, warning Bruno to keep quiet, fearful of the danger his words could bring. Pavel, an elderly waiter, reveals a more direct connection to the camp. After Bruno falls from his tire swing and badly cuts his knee, Pavel carries him inside, cleaning and bandaging the wound with surprising skill. He mentions being a doctor before coming to out with, though he grows evasive about why he now serves meals. When Mother discovers Pavel treated Bruno, she commands, "If the commandant asks, we'll say that I cleaned Bruno up," claiming credit from fear that Father will learn a prisoner touched their son. Through Maria and Pavel, we witness how ordinary people become complicit in atrocity through fear and dependency, yet their small kindnesses reveal that human decency persists even under oppression. Nearly a year later, the family returns to Berlin for Bruno's grandmother's funeral. After a lice discovery, Father shaves Bruno's head. Looking in the mirror, Bruno realizes he now looks just like Shmuel, who laughs and agrees the next day, adding, "only fatter." When Bruno learns they'll return to Berlin within the week, he dreads telling Shmuel. Their impending separation coincides with Shmuel's growing distress over his father's disappearance. This crisis sparks their final adventure. Since Bruno's shaved head makes him resemble camp prisoners, Shmuel suggests he could wear striped pajamas and slip under the fence to help search. The next day, despite rain, Bruno sneaks out. Shmuel provides striped pajamas that smelled terrible. After changing and removing his boots, Bruno crawls under the fence. The boys stand awkwardly together for the first time, each wanting to hug, but neither doing so. Walking into the camp, Bruno is shocked. No happy families or playing children, just sad, skinny people. Bruno admits he doesn't like it there and wants to go home, but remembers his promise. After searching for over an hour, soldiers suddenly surround them, forcing everyone into a march. Despite Bruno's protests about needing to get home for dinner, they're swept along with 100 others into an airtight room. As the door closes with a metallic sound and darkness falls, Bruno holds Shmuel's hand tightly, having just told him, "You're my best friend, Shmuel, my best friend for life." Bruno vanished without a trace. Soldiers found his clothes near the fence, but Father's search yielded nothing. Mother waited months at Outwith before returning to Berlin with Gretel, who spent much time crying alone. Father remained another year, growing harsh with his soldiers. When he discovered the loose fence section near Bruno's clothes, the truth devastated him. He sat in almost the same spot where Bruno had spent his afternoons. Months later, soldiers came for him. He went without complaint, no longer caring what happened. The fence that separated Bruno and Shmuel couldn't protect either from humanity's darkest impulses. Through Bruno's innocent eyes, we confront our capacity for cruelty and willingness to ignore suffering. Yet their friendship reminds us of our capacity for connection. The tragedy isn't just that Bruno dies alongside Shmuel, it's that his innocence represents our collective failure to prevent atrocity. This story happened long ago, yet its warning echoes forward. The fences we build to separate ourselves ultimately imprison us all.